Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 235 of the Professional Book Nerds podcast, presented by Overdrive. This is Jill. Hi, Adam.
How's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm back.
You are back.
Actually, at this point, I've been back for like a week.
You've been back for a while.
Yeah. I'm good. I am still a little tired, but man, if you guys ever get a chance to go to BookCon or a event like it, like New York Comic Con, Comic Con San Diego, or since I know we have a lot of international users now because of our Viber community, any of the like London Book Fair, Frankfurt Book Fair, and I know they're all over the world.
They are.
It's so refreshing to see. I think I tweeted this if people follow me. I don't know if I tweeted it as a podcast, but like seeing literally thousands of young readers like sprinting to go get author autographs and books. It's super refreshing. It's really cool to see. So.
Yay books.
Yeah, yay books is right. Yeah, I'm back. If people didn't listen to the last episode, you did a huge favor. I came back and we were like, I don't have anything to talk about. I'm so tired. And so you gave everyone a bunch of tips on using Libby and Overdrive.
I did.
I loved it. I told you that. I literally listened to it like 5 in the morning while walking my dogs.
I did some of my favorite Overdrive tips and tricks.
Yeah.
Because you know, as I said in the... The thing, I was an Overdrive user long before I came here, so.
Yeah, and so if you didn't listen to the last episode, if you saw like, oh, well, there's no book recommendations, definitely listen to it because Jill gave a bunch of different awesome ways.
I thought about that after.
No, oh, that yeah, this wasn't me like shading you.
Yeah. I was like, oh, I probably should have talked about books.
No, yeah, this wasn't me trying to like dunk on you. No, this is me being like, if you saw it and you're like, oh, well, there's no books, definitely check it out because it's such a good one. One of the things you mentioned there and we mentioned before, if you haven't joined our Viber community yet, definitely do that. You can find it at professionalbooknerds.com. We have a link to it. Just like last night at the time of recording, we had people join from Ireland, England, Scotland, and the Philippines all in like an hour, which is super cool to see. So there's readers literally from all around the world in there. And you, of course, can talk to the two of us, some of our coworkers. It's good stuff. If people want to get a hold of us other than that, though, how can they find us?
You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at ProBookNerds, and they can email us at ProfessionalBookNerds@Overdrive.com.
Yes, they can. Okay, so today's interview, I was just at Book Expo America and BookCon doing interviews, but today's interview is with Elizabeth Cohen, who's the author of The Glitch, who I spoke to in Philadelphia during PLA. So The Glitch, we get into it obviously when we have the conversation, but it's about this female CEO of a tech company whose life is like literally she tries to live her life the most efficient way as possible. Like she takes naps when she's standing up and like she schedules sex with her husband. Like they literally have everything on a schedule. But one day she meets a young woman who looks just like her and has like an identical scar and she's trying to figure out like, okay, wait, what happened here? What's going on? So it's really funny. It's kind of like Silicon Valley meets like maybe a time traveling novel or maybe not. It's really good. She was laughing, she said, because she used to work kind of in that industry. And I believe she discussed like, it's really hard to poke fun at people in the like in Silicon Valley because it's like, it's almost like the jokes are just sitting there waiting to be made anyway. So I think you guys will enjoy this. I believe if I remember correctly, peek behind the curtain. I haven't edited the actual interview as we're doing this intro. I'm pretty sure there's a part where, because when you go in these convention centers, they're huge, and there are birds flying around sometimes. I think we had a bird flying around us for a little while, so
nice.
I may or may not edit that out. We'll see. So yeah, that's this interview. Again, go listen to Jill's episode that previously was on, join our Viber community. We got everything else. We could probably talk about a book or two we've been listening to or reading if you want to give a book recommendation.
I don't really have any.
Okay.
I'm in one of those lulls where I'm between books.
Yeah. The only one I will say, and I did mention this in the Viber community, so people may be on hold already if they heard me say it. Just last week, a book came out by Violet Ramis Steele. It's the daughter of Harold Ramis. It's called Ghostbusters Daughter. I have not read it or listened to it yet, but I'm going to. I'm a huge comedy nerd. So Harold Ramis, for people who might not know, wrote Ghostbusters, wrote Caddyshack, wrote Groundhog Day, directed several of them, was in multiple movies. You've also probably seen Stripes, Knocked Up, all sorts of things. He was a comedy genius.
Someone, I want to say it was probably Entertainment Weekly or People or something, had an excerpt from the book earlier this week. And yeah, it made me want to read it.
So. Yeah, there's a story that someone had that's all about how he and Bill Murray, like they had a 20-year feud that I knew, it was very famous that they were feuding, but no one ever knew why, because they're both very private people, and they also never knew how they ended up making up, and his daughter tells that story, and I don't want to spoil it, because it's the most Bill Murray story, I think, humanly possible. Like, if any other actor had done what they did to make up, I'd be like, that's not true, but with Bill Murray is one of those people who's just larger than life, so yeah, like, yeah, though, this is how they made up. So that's the Ghostbusters daughter. I'm going to be listening to that as soon as it becomes available to me. So, anything else you think people should know about?
I don't think so.
Okay, cool. Thank you again for pinch hitting for me on the previous episode, and I hope you guys all enjoyed this interview I did with Elizabeth Cohen on the Professional Book Nerds podcast. Hi everyone, it's Adam again, and today I'm joined by debut author Elizabeth Cohen, who studied comparative literature at Princeton University and has an MA from the writing seminars at Johns Hopkins and an MLS from the University of Maryland, which we're going to talk about seeing as how we're at a library conference.
Go librarians.
Her debut novel, The Glitch, comes out this May. So Elizabeth, thank you so much for chatting with us today.
Adam, thanks so much for having me here.
Okay, so can you get us started by maybe giving people a little bit of an introduction to your novel?
Sure. So my novel is called The Glitch, and it's easy to remember because it rhymes with a word that's used often to describe powerful women, and it's about a powerful woman who is the CEO of a tech company in Silicon Valley her product is, the product the company makes is starting to malfunction, and her personal life, she's a mom and also, you know, is married, and is also kind of falling apart, and as everything starts to mount up, her very hyper-efficient, very organized life is starting to fall apart.
Mm-hmm. And there is something very interesting that happens a little bit later. Doesn't she kind of meet someone very similar to herself?
Right. She's been watching like Too Much Younger or something. She encounters a person. She is a survivor of a lightning strike, which happened when she was 20 and living on, you know, a farm in Wisconsin. And she, 20 years as the anniversary of the strike approaches, she meets a young person who she believes to be her younger self, and has to kind of cope with that.
So I don't normally ask this because it's a lazy interview question, but trying to wrap my head around the plot of this story is so unique. I just had to ask, like, where did the idea of that come from, of like seeing your younger self? Was it?
I feel like that is very much in the air right now, or was in the air, and it actually is something where I started thinking about, considering how often it crops up in movies and plot and fiction, it's sort of like, do people actually walk around thinking like, that could be me at 60 sitting over there at that table?
Yeah.
And it's like, actually, to be totally honest, I have had thoughts like that, but it's like, how normal are those, and how much are those a sign that your life is actually not working out if you're starting to like, okay. I think Shelley is someone who's so aggressively sure of herself and what she's doing that she can't really let herself have doubt. So when she's having these doubts about how things are going, they have to take this very strange physical form.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's more so being, it's more so built out of, like you said, kind of experiences of seeing someone be like, oh, that could be me, as opposed to like when I initially was reading the plot about it, I was like, is this more like a time slip thing, like Outlander, like something, like seeing someone?
So I watched the Back to the Future trilogy repeatedly while writing this, because
wonderful.
I feel like that teaches you everything you need to know about how like time travel works.
Of course.
And it's very tricky when you get right down into like into time travel stuff. In the end, and I will say that I played with the idea of like, should this be a time travel book? In the end, I feel like it works better not as a time travel book.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the possibility of time travel and the idea of kind of sort of genuinely thinking that that might be something that could happen to you is an interesting one.
Yeah.
And hopefully that comes through.
So do you have a background in the tech industry, or kind of what made you want to write
as a peon, like not as a CEO? I worked, my first job out of school was working at a PR agency in the DC area, and it was a high-tech PR, like we had only tech companies as clients, and this was right before like everything kind of went south for the tech industry. And things were going really well for a while, and we were pointing money, and it was never totally clear to me what we were really doing or what our value was, but they were paying us a lot of money.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, and then sort of it all kind of very fast went south. And as a first job, I think it was a really confusing first job because it was kind of like very unclear, like what kind of widget we were making and why certain widgets were working and certain widgets weren't. And it was the kind of job where like everyone was so terrified about the millennium bug. Do you remember that? And,
oh yeah.
And I remember like all the high up people at the agency were all spending like New Year's Eve in like a bunker with our clients, like waiting for the world to be destroyed. Anyway, that was my first job, and then I later on went to library school, and I thought that it would be an escape from all of that stuff, but I got into library school and being a librarian right when librarians were kind of falling in love with the idea of technology.
Right.
The University of Maryland renamed itself the iSchool while I was there, the library school. Went to high school, and they had a little library that was like a lab for students, and they like destroyed it and made it into a collaboration space, which was like a computer lab when it was, you know, finished. And I just felt like I was always kind of being forced into these confrontations with technology.
So do you think going through, first off, I imagine you just had so many buzzwords that you knew.
Oh, I have so many I didn't use. I'm like waiting to, you know.
Yeah, I honestly,
I'm done
that's
with tech.
Well, I do a lot of, I mean, I work at Overdrive, which is a technology company in the library, and I do a lot of our blog writing, so I'm very industry standard and leading technology. I know all about the buzzwords.
Yeah.
But do you think working in that kind of technological field where you had to write about this stuff, even if you didn't fully understand it, do you think that helped you as you were going into library school with how things were changing?
So when I actually wrote this book, I was doing neither of those things. I was working at a very stressful nonprofit communications job, and it was really more the stress that I think fueled the book in certain ways. Like my experience of being so stressed so much of the time and realizing that there sometimes is no solution. Like you just, how is it going to work? The tech buzzwords, I think, are just so prevalent now, and they're used across industries. And, you know, in my jobs, people would say things in meetings, and you'd be like, what? Like, does that even make sense for one moment? And it gave me a way to kind of reuse that all that stuff, like to sit in a meeting and kind of keep a column of these words, which later I could handily repurpose for my fiction. So I don't think that it's something that at this point is really, I think that it's too late, like the jargon.
Yeah.
Pony is out of the bag. That's not a metaphor. We should really
Pony's out, I love Pony's out of the bag.
All right, well, whatever.
I love it. I'm keeping it. Okay, so Shelley is very much, like, it sounds like she's a much very heightened kind of, like, version of what you'd see as, like, a tech industry person. But do you think a lot of the stress you were feeling ended up being built into her character? Like, do you think
I mean, I think that's where that was sort of the point of entry. Like, I had this idea to write about a female tech CEO. It was kind of when female tech CEOs were having this moment. It's the way cupcakes had their moment at one point, but a different thing. Sheryl Sandberg, you know, was doing Lean In. This was around 2013. And Marissa Meyer became, you know, the head of Yahoo. And there were those fake Shepherd Fairy posters of her head everywhere. And I just felt like it was an interesting cultural phenomenon, like both that they're so high profile and the way that we see them. And so I had this thought of writing a novel about a female tech CEO, and it felt like, how would I do that? Like, I am not myself a female tech CEO. No female tech CEO is going to write a book like this.
Right.
And trying to not make it like a cartoon or like make her too fakey.
Yeah.
And so the stress was definitely kind of the point at which I thought, well, this is something that I know. Like, I know what it feels like to be intensely stressed from your job.
Yeah.
And like, that's something I can work from.
I feel like, honestly, with the tech industry especially, it's almost it's almost impossible to, like, jump the shark with how absurd people can be. Because, like, I mean, you see the show Silicon Valley. I don't know how familiar you are with it.
I am very familiar with it.
Okay, so in my mind, like, I feel like, even you could have the most astronomically insane character in the book, and people could still be like, yeah, I could see that happening. Like,
Well, I mean, I think what is interesting and what has really changed is, when I started writing this, it was like there was a level of ridiculousness that didn't seem fully recognized as ridiculousness. Like, people were doing, you know, these sort of absurd things, and they were getting kind of a pass. Like, you know, oh, you know, it's so great, it's so innovative, it's so clever, it's so whatever.
Yeah.
What's really shifted over the past couple of years that I've been writing the book, and also now very suddenly in the last 2 weeks, is that now it's not just, like, sort of silly. It's, like, it's kind of criminal, and it's also kind of, like, highly corrosive for our society, and it's caused like problems that are not just like funny problems, like, oh, the quinoa didn't get delivered to Google's cafeteria, what will they do? It's like you know, we have a president. You know, things have gotten bad fast, and I think it's really easy to pin the blame on some of these decisions that were clearly not thought out at all.
So, I know that obviously you said that that's more now, so, but what, I guess, motivated you to want to write? Because writing a novel is no small task. This is your debut novel, and you were doing it while you were working. So, were you always the type of person that kind of wrote on the side, or?
So, like, at times. I did, right out, I wrote in college, like, with some, like, you know, I'm going to be a writer kind of feeling. Mm-hmm. And then I went to Hopkins for grad school in creative writing.
Right.
And I felt like I was, writing was my, you know, thing that I was doing. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, then I started working. I had kids, and I have gone through long periods of not writing. Like, it's not, I'm not someone who writes every day, sort of rain or shine. But at some point, the pressure of not writing sort of became its own form of distress. Like, I began to feel like I was getting older and feel like, you know, the years start slipping by. Like, I'm not that old, but I do feel like the sense of, like, the years are definitely getting faster.
Yeah.
The kids went to school, and I feel like there's this very retro thing where, of women authors of, like, a previous generation, where they seem promising and then they have kids and their life falls apart. But then the kids go to school and they actually are able to kind of pull it out and write books later in life. And I feel like that's kind of the pattern for me, like a playbook of a different era. But once my kids were in school, I did start kind of writing again. Mm-hmm. And it was hard to write while, like, working full-time and having kids. But it is also, like, kind of, I miss it. Like, I'm not working on a novel right now, and I do miss having it. It's something that you just have that's your own, you know?
Right. And so along those lines, I feel like it's the life of an author is, to me, it's such a unique experience, because you are, even if you're working full-time, when you're writing this, you're in a room and you're writing and you're by yourself and you're secluded.
That's a common misconception, right? Like, that you're in a room and you're writing by yourself. Like, I don't actually have a room where I'm writing by myself. I would, you know, love
so you're
to
just kind of, like, writing while there's, you know, kids around and dinner's on the table.
I mean, like in a way that's kind of demoralizing to me, honestly. But, yeah, when I got my agent, that was, like, a really big turning point for me, because I had had an agent years ago, but, like, I had not had one for a long time, and my agent is so great. And, like, when she took on the book, I really just felt like it's going to work out. Like, I ended up doing a lot of rewriting after that, but I had the sense, like, she gets it. She understands what I'm doing. Like, there's something there. It was, for me, really, like a big moment. And so, and I had this thought, like, now that I have an agent and I'm rewriting with, like, some purpose and maybe future in mind, I'm sure that I will do all my writing at, like, a desk in a room with, like, a cappuccino next to me, because that's what I've seen on, like, the internet.
Right.
And that I will have, like, a little laptop and, like, an orchid, and I will spend lots and lots of time doing it. And that's not what happened. What happened was I just kept doing it the way I'd been doing it, which is, like, on my sofa with my laptop, like, kids, like, please, you know, turn off that beeping, whatever. I went to Starbucks a lot. I wrote a lot of my book at the Balakinwood Library. I patronized a lot of coffee shops. And that's kind of, I just wrote it, like, little by excruciating little bit. And I got up early every morning and just kind of worked for, like, 40 minutes. You know, by the time you make the coffee, like, there's not that much time. And it really is, like, a testament to, like, you can do something in tiny chunks.
Yeah.
It's kind of, it would be more fun to go move to Switzerland for, like, 3 months and write it in a chalet, but, you know, I wrote it in my real life. And
There's when I was growing up, I played baseball throughout college when I was growing up.
Oh, you did?
Yes. And so when I was growing up, I could always hit, so they'd always find a place for me in the field. So I played every position in the outfield. I played first, third. Literally, they would just stick me somewhere and say, don't mess up too much. But when we were playing, when I was really younger, we were losing this game by, like, 11. And our coach said the most asinine thing to me, that at the time I was like, you are insane, but it stuck with me. And he said, he's like, how do you eat an elephant? And we all just stared at him. He's like, one bite at a time.
Yeah.
And that's how I feel like writing a novel is, like, it's like, you can't, in movies, I was talking about this with an author earlier today. In movies, you see those, like, aha moments where the author writes 80,000 words in a night. Like, that doesn't happen.
Yeah, not in my nights.
I don't think anyone's nights ever have that.
Too bad.
So, but I think it does take, it takes a certain kind of discipline to be like, all right, I'm going to write 200 words today.
Yeah.
And go on.
It's kind of, it's sort of also, it helps that you don't know how much work it's going to be at the front end. Like, I feel like I always believed that I was, like, 3/4 of the way done. And it turned out, like, that was so not true. I was, like, a ninth of the way done. But believing somehow that things are moving along is really helpful.
So did you, you mentioned, you know, a big turning point was getting a literary agent. How much of a manuscript did you have when you sent it? When you started kind of
I thought I was done. Mm-hmm. I thought I was done for years. I had a manuscript with when Alexandra, my agent, took it on, she was like, I really don't think the last quarter is working. Mm-hmm. And I agree that it was not. And so I rewrote the last quarter of the book, but honestly, there were a lot of things that I had not, you know, you kind of, sometimes you can get away with stuff, and then when you go back, you realize you can't really get away with the things that you've done. So
yeah.
So I had to actually, like, take the machine apart and mm-hmm. kind of put it back together, and it was sort of an excruciating experience.
So when you wrote the first manuscript, are you kind of a planner or a pantser? Like, is it...
Oh, I'm such a pantser. I wish I weren't. I've written so much material that's not in this book, and mm-hmm. I just feel like there's got to be a more efficient way. I think that the answer is there's not, but
yeah.
I just feel like I work in Scrivener, you know?
Uh-huh, yeah.
And it's like, so you can see, like, all these scenes, and only some of them come out into the actual, mm-hmm. like, manuscript, but you can see, like, all the scenes that never made it, and it is kind of, like, you read it and just think, yeah. Oh my goodness. Like,
So, but writing kind of flying by the seat of your pants at the beginning, when you're going from page one to getting to the end of the story, do you think because you're sort of meeting these characters as you're writing them,
right.
Do you think that helps with the editing process after having the hindsight now, like, okay, I can go back from page one and I can reread this and I can say, like, okay, this thing happens later in the novel, let's change what happens up here. Do you think it helps kind of, I feel like if you have this massive outline of a book before you start writing it, it might be
right.
challenging to then try to go back and edit as well, because you have
it's so outside the way that I work that I don't really know how that would be.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I went into the book knowing certain things which aren't really even the things that I knew. That she would be a CEO, I knew she would be really, really into efficiency, I knew she would meet her younger self, that was always really important to
mm-hmm.
me, and I knew that I wanted it to start out not in the United States, so
mm-hmm.
that was an important piece for me. And kind of that was all I really had.
Yeah.
And you do notice, I thought my phone was ringing. I do notice that over the course of the book that, you know, you start, like, I got a dog partway through the writing of the book, and, like, there's suddenly all these more dogs in
uh-huh.
the book. And, like, there are things like that which kind of reflect the way
things
are going. Like, you just kept adding
yeah.
dogs, you know.
What kind of dog? This is important.
My dog is, he was a rescue, but he's a mini Labradoodle. And he's adorable, and his name is Murray.
My wife and I's best friends have
yeah.
a little Murray. He is a corgi.
They do, a dog named
he's
Murray.
He's a little chubby corgi. They're gonna yell at me for calling out their
yeah.
puppy. They're a little chubby corgi named Murray. But yeah,
that's funny. I thought we had the only Murray, but he's really, really cute. And
yeah,
yeah, and he's great. And, like, yeah. So anyway, that's why there's suddenly all
no.
These
that,
dogs.
That's okay. Okay, so. Shelley, as a character, she's almost like an anti-hero, I feel like.
Yeah, she's not super likable.
But at the end, you end up kind of rooting for her. Like, are these the types of characters you like to read as a reader, like as a person who's finding other books?
I feel like that is hard to answer because I like a lot of different books. I do feel like there, you know, I heard someone say recently, and I thought it was sort of smart, it was somebody who was talking about, like, likable heroines in fiction, and they were like, you know, I just don't like nice people that much. And I was like, well, I would never say I don't like nice people, but I do think that there's something really freeing about just kind of, there are parts of you, you know, like, no one is nice all the time, and there is something nice
yeah.
about just being, like, the freedom of letting yourself
uh-huh.
go down these roads that are kind of a little more extremist, and that are things you might not say to people in real life,
yeah.
because, yeah.
Oh, I mean, like, one of my favorite books of all time is A Confederacy of Dunces.
Oh, yeah.
And the main character is just a terrible person.
Yeah.
But at the end of that, you're like, at the end of it, you're like, okay, that's...
I think if you're trying to write a book that's funny, and obviously that book is, like, the
yeah.
funniest of funny, it's like, you kind of have to sacrifice, like, you have to kind of go
mm-hmm.
down some roads, you know?
Yeah. That's totally fair. Okay, so, just because we're at a library conference.
Okay.
So you went to library school. Did you actually get a chance to work as a librarian?
I worked at the University of Maryland Libraries. I worked in I was an archivist.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked in the literary archives.
Yeah.
In the academic library, Hornbeck Library. And I really like the archivist, and I thought I would really like being an archivist because it seems like a really great job, and it seems like it's going to be so fun to like read people's diaries. I didn't love it as much as I expected.
Sure.
I think in part because it's like the Amtrak quiet car of jobs, and I didn't think about this ahead of time, but like I will never ride in the Amtrak quiet car because I find it incredibly stressful.
Yeah.
You know, like that someone's going to break the quiet and then someone else is going to confront them about breaking the quiet. And that almost the anxiety of those interactions makes it impossible for me to concentrate on anything. So I'm so ready. And I'm like sort of identifying who it's going to be and then who's going to spring into action to suppress the...
These feel very Shelley traits, what you're doing
right
now.
That's sort of, I mean, I did write this book.
There's little bits of like thinking four steps down the line of like, okay, someone's going to do something wrong. Who is that person going to be?
Who's the person? Worrying about, or just maybe it's being scared of confrontation, which she's not, but maybe I am. But the archives was a little bit like the quiet car in the sense that people were, it was very, very quiet. And so people like really loved and craved the quiet. And I found it a little much.
Yeah.
And I found it, and the desks were sort of salted through the stacks. So you couldn't actually see anyone, but you could kind of hear it if anyone did anything. And so, like, I had a terrible cough. My son was sick. And I would spend all my time, like, suppressing the cough, but then every once in a while I would cough, and the curator would, like, somehow materialize, like, Jeeves, and be like, can I give you a Ricola? And it was always, like, the Ricola of shame, you know? And it was just, like, I felt like there was a lot of stuff like that.
So... What was your actual like the day-to-day job of an archivist?
So I processed collections.
Sure.
And I was like a learning how to be an archivist, and I arranged papers, you know, like you arrange things, and there's a lot of pressure, like you got to get this done, you know, the papers of this long dead Marilyn poet have to get arranged by like next Tuesday.
Yeah,
you know, I mean it's like
for some reason.
Yeah, like. It's not a job without its stresses.
Yeah.
It's just, and I also worked on a digital humanities project, which was a lot of coding things in XML.
Was there any, when you were doing the archivist stuff, was there anything that you kind of uncovered that was like super interesting or like something you had never expected to see?
I mean, there are collections in the library that haven't been processed. Like, you know, they get the papers and they don't process them right away, so you do see stuff that they don't know that they have, but it was not like, you know, gold bricks. It was like,
it's not like a national treasure situation.
Yeah, I mean,
like
I guess
Indiana Jones.
They were filming National Treasure too on
campus
when I was there. Yeah, I wanted to be an extra, but somehow it didn't work out. I don't know what happened there.
Okay, so in your what has to be limited free time,
when you
choose to read a book, what are some of the books or genres or things that you tend to read?
I read pretty widely, and I feel like I also listen to audiobooks a lot, and I also read on my phone a lot, so I feel like I'm kind of a multimodal reader.
Yeah.
I do read a lot of fiction. Right now I'm reading a lot of old fiction, because I think somehow, I don't know, there's something odd about having a book coming out, and it's like you just kind of want to read stuff of people who are dead, who you're never going to run into, whose Twitter is never going to like show up in your
town. That's amazing.
So like right now I'm reading... a collection of like Edna Ferber short stories, which is very good, and it's funny. I mean, it's super dated, but it's I'm liking that. I do like stuff that's funny. I've kind of reached the point in my life where it doesn't have to be great if it's funny. You know, like I'll go, and I read a fair amount of nonfiction.
Yeah, I find myself doing like because I. Listen to audiobooks.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I listen to audiobooks a ton. I read ebooks, but I also read physical books. This is kind of a misconception people at Overdrive. They're like, so you don't have any books, right? I'm like, if you come to our office, there are just stacks.
I'm sure.
But for me, it's like my audiobooks tend to be like YA fantasy. For some reason, I just love listening to those. The books that I read on, like, as an ebook can be anything, but I feel like all the ones, like, it's so stupid, but the ones that I almost, like, want people to see me reading are the ones that I end up reading as a physical book,
where
they're just, like...
Oh, that's funny,
And it doesn't matter what genre, if it's a big deal, like, there's a book out right now called Children of Blood and Bone by Tomi Ayomi. I interviewed her last year, so we became buddies, and, like, I got her copy of the book, and, like, the day before it came out, I made sure I was in public
insider,
showing it off. I was just such, like, a gross human. I'm just like, yo, me? Oh, what's that? Yes, it's my book. I feel like...
I just picked up all these galleys and advanced reading copies so that I can go show them around. Yeah, it is the best.
It's the absolute. Forever, I've always tell people, if you don't, if you've never been to a conference like this, like the Public Library Association or ALA or BEA, it's so much. It's you go from like begging to get books online to like publicists just throwing them at you. Oh man. Okay, so towards the end of our podcast, we do 9 questions. We call them the Nerd 9.
Okay.
They're not rapid fire because I go down tangents.
Like buzz in with like a little.
Yeah. So the first one, you kind of answer this, but what's the last book you finished reading?
I just finished. Well, I actually just finished 2, and they're different. Can I tell both?
Absolutely. Or,
one is Tim Kreider's essay collection, which I think is called like "I Wrote This Book Because I Love You." I think.
Fantastic.
And he's very funny, and it was very funny, and I recommend it. And then I also read another good book, which is. I think it's called Houseman Country, and it's by Peter Parker.
That sounds really familiar.
It's big. It's like a book about a Shropshire lad, the poems, and about Houseman's life. And it sounds a little dry, but it's actually very lovely and readable, and it reprints all of the Shropshire lads. So if you haven't read it, you can read it again.
Yes.
And it's very atmospheric about, like, you know, long country walks in England. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really good.
Do you have a favorite place to read?
In bed mostly at night, and I really do like listening to audiobooks in my car.
Yeah, I have so many people tell me they read in bed, and I can't.
What's your job, right?
So well, that too, but it's more so that like I feel like I'm falling asleep all the time.
Well, there's that.
Because I just love my bed. I love my bed so much.
But it's the one place where I don't have any competition for other things to do. You know, it's like.
Yeah, I don't have children early on. I have my 2 little 4-legged children, and they just, my dogs will just lay down.
They're
like, they kind of just like, they look at me and they give up. They're like, okay, he's got one of those big things on his hand. He's not going to pay attention to us. Do you remember the book that made you fall in love with reading when you were younger?
I did really like reading. Like, I don't remember ever not liking reading as a thing. I was talking about books that I'd read earlier today.
Yeah.
I have to say, like, Girl of the Limberlost was a book that I read when I was in elementary school that made a huge impression on me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this very intense story of this girl in Illinois or Indiana, I think, who lives on the edge of a swamp, and she has to collect these rare moths and sell them to, like, be able to go to school.
Oh, interesting.
It's very intense, and I actually got it out of the library this week because I wanted to mention it, and I wasn't, you know, hey, you just want to, like, see what it is and if it's what you thought it was.
Oh, absolutely.
And I'm only partway into it, but it's really, really good.
That's awesome. I always worry about that.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to go back and
read. Or you're going to find out that it's, like, it's known as, like, a bad, you know, like,
yeah,
just something.
Exactly.
Or,
well, like, I'm a huge Muppets fan. Like,
everything
in my life has revolved around Jim Henson. So, in somewhere there. And so every Christmas, we used to watch Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas, which is obscure.
I've heard of this, though, I think.
And so a few years ago, my oldest sister and I were like, man, we should watch that again.
Yeah.
And we watched, we were like, ugh, this is.
That's always the worst, where you go back and sometimes you go back and it's fantastic. Like, I was listening to music that I listened to like last when I was in college, and it's like really very good.
Well, and I think music also, you get the nostalgia thing.
Yeah,
like, you can remember those moments
emotional.
In time.
Yeah. But no, books are movies are really hit or miss. We've been watching even like the Back to the Future movies, which I remember is just like they are the best movies ever, but I had my kids watch them whenever I was watching them as part of this, and it's not like the stuff in the car where he's like trying to like make out with his mother and she's saying no, like it's not as great, like
it's not great,
it wouldn't fly, you know, like,
I think maybe movies, because they're a visual medium, like they capture a moment more, like books can be kind of timeless, music can definitely be timeless.
But movies really do take, like, even Groundhog Day, again, another movie where I thought it was going to be really good for everyone.
Yeah.
And then there's weird stuff in that, too.
Oh, yeah, we actually watched it a couple weeks ago.
The stuff where you won't let her, I have little boys, and so, like, he wouldn't let her leave the room. And so, like, after it, I was like, guys, like, this is not, you know.
Yeah, or, like, this is why these are not rapid fire, by the way, because I just get sidetracked. Or, Trading Places with the Christmas movie.
I haven't seen that in a while.
Very racist.
Yeah.
Like, shockingly racist. We're like, whoa, when did this come out? But
the shocking racism is a problem. One of the books I loved as a kid was Auntie Mame, which I really loved. Like, I read that book 100 times. I thought it was hysterical. I have a copy, and I got it down, and I thought, well, maybe my son, who is 13, has a good sense of humor. Like, maybe he would enjoy it. And you flip through, and there's some, like, awful stuff.
Yeah.
And I was so different time, different like, yeah. eyes, and I was able to just sort of skate through it without realizing there was anything terribly wrong. But he's like a kid of today, and yeah. he would know immediately this is really bad.
He's probably a little woke, as
yeah,
they
he's
say.
A lot, the kids are a lot woker.
Yeah. What is one place you'd like to travel that you have not yet been to?
I'd like to go to Capri.
Oh, nice.
It just sounds nice.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite holiday to celebrate?
I like Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. We go to my parents and they do all the work. And
yeah.
It's really nice.
All food, don't have to worry about presents and all that good
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, I think Thanksgiving.
Coffee or tea?
Coffee.
I think I know the answer, but cats or dogs?
Dogs, yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Do you have a favorite food?
I love marzipan.
Ooh.
You know, like the almond paste. I really do like that. I can eat like large quantities of that.
Okay. Wow, I've had two like spreadable. Someone else earlier this weekend said Nutella.
Interesting.
Two spreadable favorites.
I think it's like if
foods.
You're really getting into it, you can just.
Yeah, absolutely. Just really get after
it. Yeah. I like balsamic vinegar a lot too.
Ooh. Oh, I like that too. Okay, and then if you could have dinner with one person, alive or dead, who would you go with?
I would pick a dead person because you like you seem like you take advantage of that. Maybe like Richard Burton or like David Niven or like some kind of movie star of the past.
Those are good ones, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, last question for you. What do you hope readers take away from reading The Glitch?
I hope that they find it funny, and it's funny, and I think it's somewhat subversively funny, and I hope that they enjoy the kind of subversiveness of it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. The best thing I ever read was when I was like 16. I read this takedown of the Frugal Gourmet in Harper's Magazine, and that like changed my life. Actually, that's a better answer than
that works.
It was like to see something that was just like on all the time in my house, just destroyed any really like ongoing like page after page kind of just nailing this guy to the wall kind of way. I just found it so liberating. Like you don't have to take the world at face value. You can. Take it the way you take it. Like you don't have to accept things the way they're presented to you. And I feel like that's kind of what I find interesting and fun about writing.
That is wonderful. Elizabeth, thank you so much
Thanks,
for joining
Adam,
us today.
For having me.
Readers can sample and borrow the titles mentioned in today's episode from overdrive.com, and our library friends can add these titles to their collections and marketplace.
Hey there.
I'm Hannah.
And I'm Audrey.
We are a sister filmmaking duo
and co-hosts of
Sleepover Cinema, our show where we analyze the films that created the collective unconscious of the girls, gays, and theys of the late 90s and early 2000s.
Princess Diaries, The Cheetah Girls, Aquamarine, Cinderella, the one starring Brandy.
We haven't stopped thinking about these movies since we first saw them, and we want you to rewatch them
and review them with us.
Are these movies as bad as critics would have us believe?
Do we even care if they are?
We are always unpacking that very question on Sleepover Cinema.
Check out Sleepover Cinema wherever you get your podcasts or at evergreenpodcasts.com.
See you soon!